Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lo Tullist, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The Story Behind the Song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out. It's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
Do you read Stephen King? Good news. There's a club for you. The Losers Club. Every Friday, us losers journey through the never-ending wastelands of King's Dominion. We sink our teeth into each of King's novels, dive deep into the lore, and review every adaptation. Even better, we're always having guests over. Thomas Jane, Will Wheaton, Mary Lambert, Mick Garris, the list goes on. So what are you waiting for? Join us as we read on through long days and pleasant nights.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith with the interview series presented by WFPK at WFPK.org, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. First off, thanks so much for checking us out, checking out this episode. If you're not a subscriber to the series, what are you doing? We put out three interviews every single week. It's a great way to keep up with all of your favorite artists, discover some new ones, and know what's happening in the music world. Of course, you can find us at all the major podcast hotspots, including iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, Stitcher, Podchaser, and YouTube, where you can also find the video versions of this interview and a lot of our interviews as well. Just type in Kyle Meredith with wherever you like to get your podcast from. Hit subscribe. We'll take care of the rest. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, I'm going to be talking with Will Butler. Yes, you do know him as one of the Butler brothers of Arcade Fire. He is back with his sophomore solo record called Generations. And it's an album where he says he's looking at his place in the world and in American history. In fact, we talk a lot about things like Schoolhouse Rock when you consider American history and music. That was one of the first things that came to my mind. Even more recently, maybe you might think of Hamilton. There's a moment on this record that sort of calls out or sort of recalls those two types of music. But for the most part, it's a really, really fun indie rock pop dance record, and we're going to get into how that came to be, why all of these things were kind of swirling around in his brain. I mean, obviously the politics, that's on all of our minds. He talks about how his wife and him, they're doing a lot for local politics, both in New York and in Arizona, so that's on our mind. But really, it's thinking about your past and how that influences your present. His in particular, going all the way back to the colonial days, or maybe even more recently, within the last century, his grandfather, Alvino Ray, was one of the very first electric guitar players who was very, very kind of famous in that scene in California in the middle part of the last century. And it's all of that that kind of swirls around in his brain that makes up these songs. So we're going to hear about a lot of that, as well as his penchant for theatrical writing, use of personas, his love of Motown. And then outside of this record, he's helped write for Broadway, something called Stereophonic that was supposed to debut this year, of course, pushed back for the pandemic. So we might be seeing that next year or the year after. He's going to tell us a little bit about Stereophonic. And of course, we'll get an Arcade Fire update as well, because there is music being made right now. But let's get into the record Generations. It's Kyle Meredith with Will Butler.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay here, man. So first off, congratulations on Generations. What a insanely catchy album, one that will get stuck. I mean, the loops I've had in my head for some of these songs. It would drive a person insane if they weren't so good songs, such good songs. So first off, congratulations on this.
Thank you.
I'll jump right into the deep end, if you don't mind, because I know there's sort of a specific thought that kind of weaves throughout this record. What I've heard you talk about is really thinking about your place in American history and the present. So I figure it's important to ask why that is. Why are you asking that specifically?
Just on a very basic level, I think we all have to ask that question at some point. It's like the coming of age novel, except it's like the coming into adulthood moment that one probably ought to have at some point in their life. You don't have to make a record about it, but you do have to like think about it at some point, just like, what, like, my God, how did we get here? Where am I going? And then, yeah, I mean, it's been a chaotic 5 years in the world, and kind of piecing together the power dynamics and like even just what is actually going on, it takes a lot of brain power. And it kind of just came out in the music. Like I've always tried to write music both here and in Arcade Fire that like emerges from like the world that I'm in. And yeah, it's been like, even before Trump, it's been a kind of a rough half decade in the world. And it's mostly been driven by what's going on in the world. Like I didn't have any massive life changes. I mean, I have three kids now. I used to have one kid, but that always does promote some introspection, but it's mostly just like, wow, things are getting rough. What do I do? I don't know. What should I do? I don't know. What do I do? What's going on?
And you're right. I mean, that seems to be what we're all asking ourselves. I mean, I don't know if you find that you have the answers, you know, because, you know, for me, you know, you speak out when you feel the passion to speak out, you know, you march when you need to march. You take care of your family when you need to take care of your family, and you hope for the best at the end point. I mean, do you find that there are any resolutions when you put pen to paper, you know, chord to progression?
No, I mean, that's essentially the tension. That's the whole record, where it's like all the lyrics are, I don't know anything. I don't know what to do. I don't know what I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to think about this anymore. Why do I have to think about this? Oh God, but I really do have to think about this. And then the music is in tension with that, because the music by its nature is so embodied and so communal. And so even though it's gonna be a long time before we can play shows, but it still is of that spirit where it is creative and affirming in and of itself. And yeah, I think in terms of concrete answers that don't appear anywhere on the record, it is like showing up for your people, which, you know, it's a thorny year for that. And it's been heartening to see people showing up for their people, but it's also been like, we're in the middle of a pandemic. So it's also like more complicated than one would hope. But yeah, I mean, that's the only sure answer. That maybe there's some other answers. Maybe there's some things we can do, but it is like, okay, let's get with our neighbors and with the people in our cities and with the people in our county and with the people in our state. And, you know, it's that
right,
spiral
right,
out.
Right. Well, that takes care of the present part, you know, and when you talk about your place in American history, I guess that opens up a little bit to where the title comes into with Generations, because I don't know if you could speak to that, but I mean, your family, I mean, we're all, as they say, we're all immigrants, and we are. But I guess you have a closer tie to that throughout your family. Is that what you're speaking to?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the record doesn't come from this, but it's kind of this, where my wife got like the 2-week Ancestry.com preview like 7 years ago. She's like, oh, I'm just going to do this. It's free. Like, I see the commercial every single time I turn on any device. And she's Jewish. And so most of her family, like a lot of them came after World War II. And then there was a chunk that came in like the 1920s. And then there was a chunk that came in like 1905. And that's all of their recorded history. I mean, they have names and they know that they were in like this part of the Russian Empire. And maybe if you go to this Ukrainian village, they haven't burned down the Jewish records, but maybe they have. So her documented history, which like is not the end all be all, but like goes back to the beginning of the 20th century. And then I was like, and then for me, it's like clicking. It's like, oh yeah, oh yeah. And then it's this guy, 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 and then it's this guy. And it's all so documented. Mm-hmm. And so it's all so knowable. And it's also, some of it's just so goddamn clear. I mean, like, just like the first butler came to Massachusetts in 1630. And they've just been Yankees. They've been on like 3 different islands in New England for like 300 years. Yeah. And there's something to that that's really beautiful. And there's something to that that's very thorny. Mm-hmm. And yeah, my one grandpa, my mom's dad, was a musician. He was like a famous musician. He was in the name of Alvino Ray. But he was born Alvin McBurney, changed his name to Alvino Ray because Alvin McBurney's a terrible name. No offense to the Alvin McBurney's out there. But he changed it to Alvino Ray for showbiz. Uh-huh. And he got famous playing the electric guitar. He was like one of the very first electric guitar players. But back, the first electric guitars were Hawaiian guitars. So he was a man named Alvin McBurney who changed his name to Alvino Ray, playing an electric Hawaiian guitar, playing jazz music on electric Hawaiian guitar in America as a white dude. It's thorny. And like, not all of that is like problematic in the, like, you have to think about the pieces. It's not like feeling guilty, though there are elements of history that I don't mind us feeling guilty about, but it is like, oh, that is literally where I come from. So what does that mean? And my mom's dad decided to be a musician in the 1880s. He was like a poor Mormon kid, son of homesteaders. His parents had been driven by religious violence outside of the bounds of America. And they went to go live in the desert in Utah. And he decided to be a musician. And that is pretty explicitly why I'm a musician. It's like, he decided to be a musician. His kids, he made his kids be musicians. Their kids were musicians. Their kids were musicians. Me and my brother are musicians. Mm. So it's like very concretely my life and my success is derived from decisions made in the 19th century. And some of that, like being a musician is very beautiful. Like being a musician from generations of musicians there's nothing wrong with that. It's like glorious. But if we're gonna concede that decisions made in the late 19th century have impacted my life today, there are many, many, many other decisions that date back to the 19th century and before that have impacted how I'm living today. And like how do I deal with that? And not everyone has to be a historian. Not everyone has to be like looking back there. It doesn't, but I am. Like that's, mm-hmm. I'm always drawn to it. I'm always drawn to just like, where did I come from? What is the antecedent? What is not the root cause, but like, what are some of the currents of mystery that have brought us to this moment? You know, not everyone has to do that, but that's just where my brain always goes. It's like, it's just like a mental tick. Like, where did this come from? Where are we going?
Thank goodness, like, you're a good musician, I guess is what I should point out. Because that's not a given, even with the history, but that is a beautiful way to look at it. There's, you know, maybe I'll start with the bottom up on this record too, because you've got this song that closes out the album called Fine that, you know, is very different from the rest of the record. And yeah. You know, viewer, listener, if you haven't heard this, you know, it's a great dance indie rock record kind of, you know, but right at the end of it, you pull out what, to me, when I first heard it, was like, my first thought was Schoolhouse Rock. You know, I don't know if you like, yeah, we're about the same age. If you grew up with Schoolhouse Rock, is like, it's not exactly that, but that's what it reminded me of. But this is you sort of tracing like actual US history in a way, right?
Yeah, I mean, it starts off with George Washington and his slaves, and then it goes to the present day. Like, it's trying to do a lot. It's, I mean, it's, yeah, it's It's like half. It's like a third Schoolhouse Rock. It's like a third Randy Newman. It's kind of trying to have the spirit of like high period Kanye, mm-hmm. of just trying to do everything and kind of being an idiot and kind of being an asshole, but like trying to just lay it all out in a way that is comprehensive. Whereas, and like, there's such, like in hip hop, there's like such a beautiful whole genres of like how I made my money and like, this is how I made my money. And my story of that is like, well, my grandpa was a small businessman. And I don't think it's a horrible thing to talk about in a song. That's like a horrible thing for even like a person to bring up. This is like this is, as a white person, this is where my power derives from. It's like, it's horrible. It's like, it's so uninspiring to hear not an underdog describe what's going on. And part of this, it's not the entire song, but part of the song is like trying to do that in like a crass way with like a Schoolhouse Rock beat.
I mean, at least coming out in the era of Hamilton, you know, it's not like it doesn't make sense, which, you know, just by pure chance, I mean, I'm talking with Leslie Odom Jr. right after this, you know, who played Aaron.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Something going on here in the universe, at least for me as the listener, you know, that really, really works, you know, and you know, it's kind of interesting how that comes out. I do want to pull up your wife a little bit here, because she herself works in government to a certain degree, right?
Well, she's been working, she's been fundraising and organizing around state legislative races mm-hmm. this year. And she's done it for a lot of races. And she's also on the record. She also plays keyboards and sings on the record. But my wife, Jenny, particularly this year, we've been focused, she's been focused, and I've been helping with the state legislative race in Arizona. Like there's a real chance that the Democrats could take one of the houses of the state government, which I could like talk about for like hours. But essentially all of the state government stuff is both a bulwark against the horrible things that a federal government might do. And it's also can be a very fertile breeding ground for good ideas and can be like a horrible idea reading around for ideas. Like the Arizona legislature were the pioneers of the show me your papers law, of like the super racist, like we're going to be even more racist than anyone else. And they, you know, state laws have that power, and it'd be very inspiring to see Arizona not choose to be super racist, because the state is full of like beautiful people of all kinds. So right. Like it should have a legislature and laws that reflect that.
But yeah, so that's what I'm getting. You know, here we have a song like Fine, and you know, sort of what you're thinking about throughout this record. And then outside of the music, like you're still surrounded by this. And to every degree, we're all still surrounded by this. But it seems like trying to say this where it doesn't sound opportunistic, but what a perfect time for you to release this record. Because, I mean, it really does seem like your life is just completely involved, even more so than most of us, I think, with what's going on around here. And I guess I'm a little like surprised or curious, like when you're writing these songs, what keeps you going full on political record? Because this isn't a full on political record. I mean, there are these moments in there, but it's not that. Is that something that you find that you purposely separate?
No, I mean, it kind of just comes out how it comes out. Like it's kind of mysterious, like it could have been a record of love songs if love songs had come out, but it's just like what, you know, I've just been thinking about history so much. So like when I sat at the piano, I was like, I guess I'm going to write about George Washington now.
Or just like,
or it's just on your brain. So you're like, it's just like, I don't know what's happening. You're just like responding to the news. Like I've been very, you know, most of us have been pretty involved with the news the last couple of years, but I've been very involved in it. It just comes out because it's what's on your mind. Right. But it is in some sense mysterious and uncontrollable, the writing. And like I think it's not possible for me, but I in the abstract it's possible to write music that's very that is completely transcendent, the nitty-gritty of the world. Not that it never can believe, but anyway, it just to me it's always like what's on my brain, and then it comes out in the music and you're like, oh, okay, and that's what it is. And that's also why it's not a super political record. That's why it's not an Idols record, which is amazing, but it's like a Clash record. It's like a and we're going to talk about this. We're talking about this. And it isn't that for me, because even with all of the news and all of the thought and all of the work that's happening, it's still not everything.
I'll bring up so my favorite song on here, I do believe, is Promised. Promised, that, you know, the first time I listened to it was in the car, you know, and I had it on, and suddenly it comes on. First time I hear it, I'm the guy dancing at the stoplights, yeah. You know, not caring yes. about everybody else around me. Just a broad question. Tell me about that song, because again, I've just kind of fallen in love with the feel of it, with the groove of it. You know, I'm already singing the hook even before I'm aware of what the song is actually saying.
Yeah. That's very much how I experience music. It's I like experience it and I'm like, what's going on? Like every breath you take is about what now? but yeah, that song is like truly was a groove. Like it was a groove that me and, because this record is very much a band record with my touring band, my drummer Miles and my sister-in-law Julie, particularly the three of us like laid down beds, and this was just a groove. It was like, this is a cool groove. And like, this is, you know, it was like chords and a feel. And we just played it. We just played it for a long time. It was one of the last songs. The lyrics weren't written or anything. And I was like, let's just like play this for a long time. And I'm going to cut this together because I know that this is something, like it feels right. And like Miles was just really feeling it, because it's not, anyway, I could talk about it forever. But yeah, it's trying to be that. It's trying to be it. It's got a little bit of LCD sound system in its bones. Like it's a little bit of just like, yeah, trying to get you to dance at the stoplight. And yeah, I'm glad it comes across that way.
Yeah, total success. I think in another interview, it may have been the Stereo Gum, you know, album write-up. You said there could be a jammier version even to come. Did you record more of that song, a different versions, or what are you talking about there?
Yeah, so we just jammed on it. We like played it on a loop. Like I didn't even have a structure. There was like the strings or the chorus and the whole thing, the bass is the whole thing this whole way. And yeah, there is something, like, because it kind of starts dramatically on the record, but there's also a way that you just, like, it's just the groove, do, 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 like, forever, right. And it kind of picks up, and, like, stuff enters, because that's how we played it, and it felt really good, but then it was that thing where records are different than playing it, and it was, like, listening back didn't exactly have the magic of the room, so you had to, like, you know, I picked, like, a bit of the faster bits, because it's like, oh, yeah, this is, like, feels like you want to dance, like it needs to be the fast bits that we played, even though the slow bits are really satisfying, but it doesn't quite work in this context. So yeah,
so there's a 12 inch version somewhere percolating.
Oh, yeah. yeah it's right on this computer behind you.
I look forward to that. The multiple voices on here, how is it that you, I mean, do you just said a minute ago this is sort of like a band record in a lot of ways, but writing for multiple voices, like there is the call and repeat moments, there is the narration weaving, like does that come through band writing, or is that something that you're able to kind of see as you're writing the song?
Yeah, I mean, that's just like fundamentally, I'm a theater kid from high school, and I can only think in dramatic terms, and I can only think in like characters on a stage. And I think every songwriter makes a persona when they're performing and when they're writing. And like, I mean, Bruce Springsteen talks about it all the time. He's like, I'm a charlatan, it's all pretend, but people do that. And to me, that persona kind of only makes sense with other people on the stage. It kind of only feels human when there's other voices. And some of that is just listening to so much Motown as in like my teens and 20s, like so much Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, where they just sound, it's just like a gang of humans, like the most wildly talented humans you've ever heard, but you still like get that sense of like, these are humans in a room. And to me, that's the only way most of the time that a lot of songs make sense, is if I'm not alone in this world, if I'm like talking with someone, because it's hard to me sometimes to like talk to a person in headphones, like talk to like an imaginary listener or talk to myself. It's like easier to like talk to this Greek chorus that follows me around everywhere.
You get that like in Surrender, you know, the first, the radio single or whatever, like I can immediately see the conversation happening, you know, like I still, you know, dozens of listens into this song, like when I'm hearing it, you know, the color, I'm imagining, like, I don't know, you know, maybe so,
It's, you know, those little moments right here. It's in like, sometimes it's like the shrug off thing. And, you know, it's really like the theatrical part I hadn't actually considered, especially when you get a song like that, which is this, again, this catchy little pop song and everything, but there is a lot of theatricness happening within that.
Yeah. And like on Bethlehem, it's like, it's just this, it's just a rant. The whole song's a rant. It's like, Jesus Christ, this is the end times. Like, what's going on? And then there's the bridge in the middle, where the other voices, where the women are like, I don't know, man, maybe. Like, maybe yes, but also we're just here together. But you can keep ranting. It's okay if you keep ranting, but you know that your rant isn't exactly reflective of reality either. And then it's like, okay, that's actually the emotion. Like, the emotion isn't I'm ranting into the void. The emotion is I'm ranting in the presence of people that love me. And that, like, we are then going to, like, figure out what to do next. And that what to do next is in the next act, which is not part of the record, but like, to me, it's there where it's like, we're here, we're together, keep ranting if you need to. And then we'll do the next thing.
Then we'll get there. That song's actually a nice also lead in or the weave we were talking about earlier to Not Gonna Die too, because there is that sense of the overreacting, the fear being thrown at you a little bit. You know, you're talking about the world's going to end, and then you have and Not Going to Die, the way people are saying, like, oh, be scared of everyone, especially who doesn't look like you. And you're like, what? I really do love that you took that angle on that one.
Yeah. And it's, I also think, like, when we name our fears, we also make them real. So even when we're being like, stop saying that, like, my freaking neighbors, you know, there was like a rumor that the neighborhood I lived in, like two of the 9/11 bombers lived here when they were studying stuff. And it's completely false. It's completely 100% false. But like, that was like what my neighbors told me when I moved in. Like, did you know? Cause we're in like a big Bangladeshi Muslim neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it's like, quit saying that my neighbors are gonna kill me. Like, are you, like, why? Like, why do you insist on that? And yet it's the way the brain works. By someone saying, like, this guy's going to kill you, you kind of picture it for a second and it works. And you're like, no, don't. It's not true. It's not, you know, this is, you know, here I am ranting again.
Well, again, I mean, the record just does take so many different angles, unexpected angles, you know, from the narration, musically. Again, it's a lot of fun. So, you know, what you've done is no small feats. And, you know, and for this just to be, like, it doesn't feel like a side project, like, you know, and I think that's what people wonder, like, you know, when Policy came out in 2015, you know, you sort of go, okay, here's the solo record. What's it going to mean? There's something about Generations, I guess, to me that makes it real, you know, that makes it feel a little bit more real. And it probably doesn't feel like that to you because you're the person in it. I mean, whether it's this or Arcade Fire, I mean, you're writing the songs, right?
Yeah. And it's, but that is essentially how it feels to me as well. Where Policy was more like scattering the bread upon the waters. It's just like, oh, I'm going to put this here. Partly because, as is in this record, I only operate on conversation. Mm-hmm. So like with Policy, it was like, I have to say something in order to hear something back, in order to say something, in order to hear something back, in order to say something. And I didn't want to think too long about what I wanted to say with Policy. And then now that I'm like friends with everybody, now I'm like, okay, I'm thinking about what I want to say. And there's like really funny jokes and really great stuff that comes out of not thinking about it too much. There's like really great meals that you just like grab the food at the market and make it really fast. And that's the best meal you've ever had. But there's also something to be said for like really thinking through what you're doing and why you're doing it. And Generations is much more that.
I love the way it worked out, the way it sounds. I'll hit a couple things outside of the album too. What is Stereophonic?
Oh, that's a really awesome play that I'm working on by this playwright David Adjemi, and it's about it's basically a band in a studio, and he through a friend, I never knew him, but through a friend of a friend, he was like, you want to write some songs? Like, it's not really a musical, this is a play about people in a studio, and so it's like them working on the song, so the songs like cycle back through, and he's a straight up genius. The play, it's like just insanely captures actually what it's like to be in a studio under the pressure and just being like, is this worth it? What are we doing? This is great. This is terrible. And yeah, it was supposed to be on Broadway. Like, there's one arts theater on Broadway. It's going to be like in the tiniest theater, but it was literally going to be on Broadway this fall. I think it was supposed to premiere like next month, and now it'll happen. It will happen, but it'll be another year. It'll be like 2022 or something like that.
Sure. Yeah.
But no, that was just like a bolt from the blue where it's like, you want to do this thing? I was like, oh yeah, I'll meet with this guy. And he's a genius. And you're like, oh, okay. Oh, this is not random. This is like really exciting.
I mean, it's Broadway. I mean, you know, not everybody gets the chance. I mean, you know, even if it's the tiniest theater, you're writing for Broadway. That's gotta be.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's second stage, or the producers, and it's like so goddamn legit and amazing. And like, you know, I was going to be in LA, and like, we were doing workshops, and it was yeah, super, like a really amazing director. And you're just like, oh, this is such an education to see people working at the top of their craft and like working together in a different way. It was very inspiring. Now, continues to be inspiring. Just stop pause.
Yeah. Am I going to hear these songs and think, oh yeah, Will Butler songs, or is this allow you to be, you know, musically something very, very different?
I hope you hear it and you're like, oh, this sounds like the band from Stereophonic. That's the dream, but we'll see.
But not the band Stereophonics, which is a different
thing. Not the band Stereophonics, just the band that is in the play, Stereophonic.
You don't sound like them, which is a great band too. I like Stereophonics.
But we'll get them to play this. It'll be like a very meta thing at some point for the like 10th anniversary.
It's going to be great. I will ask about the new Arcade Fire because I think about the conversation you and I had a couple years ago. We were at Forecastle and you guys were wrapping up the tour. And you said at that point, I think about this a lot, you were quoting Springsteen again, which I now hear is something that you like to do. It's but you were saying, now it's time for us to go away for 5 years and let everybody miss us. And that's probably the period that we've been in, right? I mean, this is the learning to miss Arcade Fire moments that we're in. But what is the update? Because it's not like you guys aren't doing anything, as I kind of get hints from here and there. Like, there's action happening.
Yeah. And I mean, it always takes us a year and a half to make a record. Like, we tour until we're sick, and then we take a long time off, and then it takes us a year and a half to make a record. And it's been a crazy year, but that schedule is not busted yet. Like, we're making the record in a different way than we would have. And if we can't physically get together, it'll be delayed and somehow, but I have to believe that we will be able to like get together safely and legally at some point. And then I think it'll happen. You never know. It's such a mysterious process. It's such a, you know, capturing a wild horse on the plains. Like, you could just end up with like a broken leg and some broken ribs, or you could just have an amazing horse in like 2 weeks. So yeah, we'll see. There's no like deadlines or anything, but kind of once we can get together, I bet it'll happen pretty fast.
Yeah, I'm really interested to hear what you guys come out with too, because, I mean, Arcade Fire does tend to write these opus thematically. And considering everything that we've gone through, you know, since the last record, like I'm really interested to see how that maybe possibly twists its way, you know, screws its way into whatever you guys are doing. So
yeah, we try to let things grow from the soil that they grow in. So yeah, we'll see what weird berries we get.
There's the album title right there, Weird Berries. It's not a great album title.
No, it's like a little, it's like our jam period. It's like Weird Berries.
Anyway. In the meantime, Will, Generations again, I know I've complimented it like a half dozen times here, but it's such a good record that you've done. And I was also a big fan of Policy as well. And, you know, in the Friday Night Live album. So thanks for continuing to make this whole side of you possible and progressing.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Hopefully there'll be a time when we do hear these songs live. I know there will be. You know,
there will be, yeah, someday. There will be blood. There will be shows. Yeah, God willing, sooner rather than later.
Yeah, right on, man. Well, thank you so much for the conversation today. It's been a lot of fun as always.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. Bye.
So the last time Will and I spoke was back in 2018. Arcade Fire, they were out on a tour, and we got to talk about his disco town halls that he was doing at the time and how he connects with local audiences on a personal and political level after the shows. Will also touched on the critical response to Arcade Fire's Everything Now. And, you know, we talked about Bruce Springsteen a few times in this interview. He talked about being mentored by the boss. So here's part two, Kyle Meredith with Will Butler.
Let's start with the Disco Town Hall. Mm-hmm. The concept behind this?
I mean, we've always, Arcade Fire has always been a very community-oriented band. We literally had four songs called Neighborhood, mm-hmm. our first record. And we did some campaign events for Obama in the primaries in 08 and played the inauguration, played the staff ball, which was fun because it was all the kids that had worked on the campaign, which mm-hmm. is amazing. But never like partisan politically or anything. But last year, I took a year, I went to the Harvard Kennedy School. They have a one-year mid-career program. I'm in my mid-career.
Look at you.
and I got a master's in public administration. It's like a public policy degree, essentially.
Wow.
Starting in the fall of 2016, which is an interesting time to be studying
right.
what is wrong and how to fix it. And, I mean, the other piece is that our band for a long time has worked with this group, Partners in Health, who started 30, 35 years ago in rural Haiti, mm-hmm. providing AIDS and tuberculosis medicine, but kind of full medical care. And they're very rigorous intellectually and morally, and they're a really powerful rights organization. I mean, kind of they've sadly had to prove time and time again that medicine works the same on poor people as rich people. It's like, actually, if you give AIDS medicine to patients in rural Haiti, it works the same as on patients in Boston. And for a number of years, they had better treatment outcomes than in Boston. Mm-hmm. And they also would have, they have a accompanateur system. It's like a community health worker system, where it's local people going from door to door, making sure people are taking their medicines, making sure that they're healthy, that they're paid. These aren't volunteers, they're paid because it's a job. People should be paid. Mm-hmm. And they would like write prescriptions for needs a new roof, because they would sell their medicine to like put a roof over their kids' heads. So it's
wow.
My politics has been very much informed by working with those guys, with Partners in Health.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I went to school in the fall, and Trump won the election, and it was super bad and weird.
It never feels right to hear it or say it. Still,
no.
It just doesn't.
But yeah, I was literally at the time, I was taking class with this woman, Leah Wright Rigueur, who's a professor at Harvard, young historian. She wrote a book called The Loneliness of the Black Republican. And everyone was like, oh, is that about you? She's like, it's not a memoir. It's a history book. but her course was essentially race in America. Uh-huh. And the last 2 weeks, the second to last week was talking about Hillary Clinton, and the last week was talking about Trump. That was like on the syllabus. Mm-hmm. And the first weeks we read the riot report on the 1919 Chicago riots. And that was like one of the through lines. We read the report on the 1919 Chicago riots. We read the Kerner report after the riots in 68. We read the Department of Justice report after Ferguson and after Baltimore, and kind of like just us doing the same stuff over and over again. And people of goodwill correctly diagnosing the problem for over 100 years, and it just being the same racist BS. And then at the end of this course, Trump got elected.
Yeah.
And like, oh.
And yesterday, I mean, Chicago's, again, facing it's smaller riots,
yeah.
But you know, we're you know, over.
Yeah,
I think about that a lot, about the history segment. I'm sorry to interrupt there.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's you know, the old line, history repeats, you know, doomed to repeat it or whatever. But it is. It's like, it's not like we're talking thousands of years ago, even hundreds yeah. of years ago. Usually, you know, we're even the election itself. You know,
yeah.
Hillary Clinton got more votes.
Yeah.
We say that more people want this than that.
Yeah.
But enough people didn't come out to vote. You know,
yeah.
and it's like, we just did that.
Yeah.
We did that 18 years ago, you know, it's like, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, no, so I, that was one of the courses, and then another course I took with this guy named Robert Putnam, who wrote a book called Bowling Alone, which is kind of like the death of civil society in America, and he very rigorously kind of shows the death of civil society in America, mm-hmm. and the question is like, how do you fix that? Like, how do you connect people? How do you make society function? Because to the extent that it doesn't function, society doesn't function, rich people will always be fine and poor people and marginalized people will always be hurt. And I'm a rich person, so me and my family will probably be fine. But as we dissolve, and we're seeing it now, we're seeing how we're treating immigrants and how we're treating people of color. And so you want to figure out how to not just like stop that dissolution of the bonds, but how do you build something positive? And we've done it in the past. And normally when we've done it in the past, we've done it at the expense of black people. Like, we've done the progressive era, and we've done the New Deal, which aspects of which are amazing. And, like, we have public schools because of it, and we have, you know, we have Social Security. But we've always kind of done it at the expense of this other, and that other has generally been black people. Right. And so, but there is some hope in me that we've done it before and we can do it again. And in my darkest moment, I'm like, at least maybe it can be a different other.
Right. But not being the evil timeline.
Not be immigrants or black people this time. May it be but in my moments of hope, it's like maybe we can do it better.
Yeah.
And so I took all these courses, and then we went on tour. I graduated in May. We went day after I graduated. Literally, I flew to Barcelona to start a tour in Europe. But then we have all these dates in America. We're going literally to every single major city in America. And we'll have 8,000 to 17,000 people in a room. And so what do you do if you have 8,000 to 17,000 people in a room who are mostly local? You have 8,000 to 17,000 locals in a room. That is a wild resource.
Yeah.
And what do you do with that? And, I mean, I'm an artist, and I think art is meaningful, and I think pure art is very meaningful, and I think you can be Emily Dickinson and, like, sit in a room by yourself and produce things of great meaning for the world. But we happen to do stuff out in public, and we happen to name our songs Neighborhood, and we happen to write our music trying to ground it in our communities. So what do you do with thousands of people in a room? And to me, trying to do politics on that level, it's pretty easy to have it approach fascism because it's just raw emotion, and it's a group of people and they bond together, and we shouldn't be scared of that when you're being just and true, but kind of want to stay away from fascism to the extent that you can. So I decided to put together after parties. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we've just had this aesthetic experience. I just played Wake Up. We all sang it together. We were all in this room. We had this moment. I know that you're thinking about the stuff that's going down right now. Mm-hmm. I know you're thinking about the election. I know you're thinking about what can you do. I know you're thinking about, I know you feel a little lost, because I feel a little lost. So let's all go to a place together and talk about some local things in your community that are happening. And so the structure of those disco town halls is we'd have an after party at a local venue, normally local promoters who are engaged in their communities. We did one in Tampa, for instance. I went, I played Stand By Me, and then I introduced all these organizers who were working on getting people who had been in prison the right to vote. Like, there's crazy felon disenfranchisement in Florida and throughout the South. I think it's 5 million, and it's something like 30% of all adult black men are disenfranchised in Florida because of being arrested on a felony charge. Yeah. So I introduced these organizers who were working on introducing a amendment to the state constitution of Florida to allow most felons to easily get their voting rights back, like have it most of it be automatic and then have some people apply. I mean, I'm a bit of a radical. I think you should be able to vote from prison. That's how we do it in Maine. Like, I'm a Yankee. That's how we do it in Maine and Vermont. But, you know, baby steps. So they're like, if you're a rapist, you can't vote anymore, but everyone else can vote, essentially. And they were working on it, and they came out and told their stories. And then every single person in that room registered to vote, and a bunch of them signed up to volunteer. And it was like a really beautiful moment in Tampa.
Right.
And I was there for a night, but it was beautiful for me as well. And then in my hometown in New York, we played Madison Square Garden, and then we went to a jazz club that our saxophone player Stuart plays at all the time, and had my city councilman come out, and an organization called the Catal Center that's working on closing Rikers Island Jail, which is, it's the jail, so it's people that haven't been convicted yet. It's all pre-trial detention. Mm-hmm. And the numbers are absurd, where people have been held before trial for years. And some of that is improving because of pressure like this, and there's a bunch of people working to close it, which I support, because I do think that places and names become poisonous, and whole systems become poisonous, and you essentially have to abolish them and start afresh, because it is things become cursed, and it's not like some mystical curse. It's like humans curse a place, and then any guard on Rikers Island knows they're a guard on Rikers Island.
They're part of that story.
And they...
Yeah,
and
continuing
it,
that.
And it just happens. Right. It perpetuates, and it's a place of violence and despair. And so we did one on closing Rikers Island, not prison, jail. And so I did 10 or 12 of those on the last tour. And then, so now we're going back through America again for 2 weeks. I actually had my son on this tour, so I was like, oh, I'm not going to do anything. I've got my 6-year-old. It's going to be, like, so bananas. But I read the news. We all, maybe, I guess we don't all read the news, but a lot of us read the news these days. And it's, I was like, okay, fine. Got to do something. Like,
well, especially, I appreciate it, because in Kentucky,
yeah,
we've got Mitch McConnell.
Oh.
We've got this horrible governor.
Yeah.
That's just the biggest Trump fan in the world, you know. And we're not exactly used to that. And this is what happens when people don't vote. I thought the same way. I was like, well, there's no chance that guy's going to get it. You know, yeah. And I took my son. We do the voting every time. He goes with me. He really enjoys that. And then, of course, the bad news the next day. So for you to come here using the podium, and even if half the time you're speaking to the choir,
yeah,
you're still inspiring them.
Yeah, and I think speaking to the choir is incredibly valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think getting people who kind of read the news and are like, I'm on your team, getting them to actually act is great. If you can get 5% of the people to actually go out and knock doors for a candidate, that's amazing.
Right.
Like, radicalizing the choir is a good thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like a straight white dude that's probably very centrist deep in my core, but the radicals are really pushing things in a good direction, I think. Mm-hmm. I think if we're ever going to get healthcare in this country, it's going to get people that who I think are probably going too far to get it to happen. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have it, and then it'll be great. So I'm trying to radicalize the choir, I think, is a worthy goal. And I also think it's, like, as an artist, when you support candidates or you support organizations, you do bring relief to them, mm-hmm. to the people, where it's like, oh, I'm a candidate for state legislature in Kentucky, but a rock band cares about me. Like, when a fan comes to me and says, I like you, I feel great for a day.
Right.
So when a band comes and says, I like you, it does. It gives you momentum. It, like, makes you feel like you're doing something. And I used to think that really wasn't important. And the more I've done this sort of work and the more I've lived, I realized that, like, being secondary support to the people on the ground is really valuable. For a person in my position,
right.
For the people that are in the places, more of us need to be first line responders. Like, more of us need to be talking to our neighbors and out on the streets when things go down. But there are levels.
Well, I certainly appreciate what you're doing. I like the position you come from too, because, you know, American, the ties with Haiti, the ties with Canada, you know, you're an international band, and I'm sure you get to see things that a lot of people don't, and they're not privy to, and to kind of bring those conversations to people that never leave their hometown, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I do want to tie that in the music, though, because, you know, it's usually there. You know, I was looking at your solo record with a song like Anna, you know, and that repeating line of money.
Yeah.
Money, you know, over and over and over. And there's the question you ask at the end of the song. What was that?
I can't remember right
neither
now.
Neither can I.
I know the whole song.
No. Well, it's just saying, you know, like, and, you know, what are you going to do when that's, you know, because I feel like it's impossible to get... Well, you can't get the money out of politics as much as we want it to, you know. Not right now.
Yeah.
Not right now. It's not going to happen. But to ask that question, to kind of push that forward.
I mean, I'm down with capitalism as long as it's an accurate social science. Mm-hmm. But the part where it becomes a value system, it's so harmful. And we're seeing the fruits of that, where we have, like, a big idiot rich buffoon,
mm-hmm.
who's like...
Whose first thing he tells Theresa May is, you should sue.
It's crazy. It's just crazy.
It's like, sue... What is that? And that's where you start with him.
No,
that's...
I mean, you need something to be a value system, and I, you know, it's hard. That's part of the struggle in our society right now, is like trying to construct a value system that isn't like money good, because that's all we've heard for the last since like 1979,
right.
Basically, is
right.
That like money good, like capitalism wins, and you're like, no. Capitalism is fine insofar as it's like a measurable economic system, but like get it out of my face otherwise.
Right.
Like, it's about your neighbors and about humans. And that's the experience of Partners in Health, is they talk a lot about human rights. But they talk about that because the missing aspect is rich people not seeing other people as humans. Like, if you just see people as human, then you give them healthcare,
right.
Then you help them, then you get them a house. So that's the part, that's why it's a human right, is because it's just that. It's like, oh, those are poor people in Lima, Peru. Like, they, whatever, they're not human. And it's literally as simple as that. But, you know, getting people that there's feedback loops as to how you actually get people to, like, wake the hell up and realize and treat other people as human. And since we're in a democracy, when our government treats people like humans, it is an expression of us, and it's a feedback loop, and we start to identify as treating people as human, I think. And I think there's real power in having a representative government and having it do the right thing. And then that, I think you get into cycles where stuff becomes better. Sometimes it takes 40 years. Sometimes it takes, I mean, who knows? So yeah. You have good days and bad days.
No, but I mean, I think that's the most perfectly said thing. If you can just get these people in power to see people as humans, as not, well, let's just separate them and put them in cages.
Yeah.
Because you don't. Because you never see them, because they're not real. They're a political token that you can gamble with.
And I don't want it to sound soft, the seeing other people as human, because oftentimes the way you get to see people as human is you get them the healthcare first, and then since you're giving them that, they are human to you all of a sudden. Like, you can't just be like, we need to focus on love first. But I'm an artist. I'm a musician. I'm kind of a Christian. I'm a weird heretical Christian. But I do believe that, but it's not a soft thing. It's a very hard, how do you provide concrete goods to people? Because that is the pudding.
Right.
That's the pudding. Eat it.
So I want to ask some stuff about the music, too, specifically. Now that you'll soon be in the middle of an Arcade Fire album cycle, because I'm sure you're probably coming to the end of the Everything Now cycle, are you looking to do any more solo records? Because we loved the last one so much.
You know,
we played a lot of Take My Side. We played Anna a lot. So,
thank you.
I don't know if that's in your plans, if that's something now that you'll, because I guess when you do that, you sort of never get to turn off either. So I don't know how important it is to.
Yeah. In a dream world, I'd have a record out next year, but it takes so long to physically manufacture the record that it might be the year after. But it's definitely in the works.
It seems like this would be the stuff that you would be singing about once again.
Yeah.
You know, when you do Take My Side, and I was thinking about the with Pete Seeger, Which Side Are You On, which Ani DeFranco just did a really great new version of that.
Cool.
I'm like, oh man, it's like an updated version of that almost. It's like, of course, when you play it next to Stand By Me, it means also something completely different to me. So I would, I'm really looking forward to what you do with all of this.
Oh, thank you.
Artistically and musically. And the Arcade Fire record with Everything Now, you know, when I thought about it in the context of what you were doing today, I thought, here's a record that I wouldn't call a political album, nor would I call any of your records political records.
Yeah.
But the culture, the environment, the atmosphere that led to this current state that we're in. Am I close when I'm sort of trying to put it all in a bubble, in a box, and say this is what this record is? Because that's what I feel like we're talking about. You know, the Everything Now idea-ism, and just that title alone, those two words right there. It's like, you know, this is the culture that we live in.
Yeah.
This is the guy who's in the White House.
Yeah. And it's utterly overwhelming, where it's the most horrifying news in the world, and then also, like, stupid news about North Korea. There's, like, terrifying news about North Korea, and there's stupid news about North Korea, and there's horrifying news about how we're treating people, and there's the World Cup,
right.
And there's...
Do you remember
Baby Balloon, and there's a hilarious joke.
Like U2's Zooropa tour. Like, this is what it feels like.
Yeah.
You know, those TVs that's just nonstop, like, oh.
I mean, that's how I feel from 8 to 11 p.m. every night when I'm, like, accidentally looking at Twitter on
my
phone.
Right.
But no, the way we always make albums is we go home and we live our lives and we try to plug into where we live and we try to let it emerge organically from that. And that's, once again, there's other ways of doing art and there's other ways of making political art, but ours has very much been grounded in living as humans in specific places and bringing that to the work.
The flip side of being a very successful artist is you also become a target every single time.
Yeah.
And because it's always, no matter what you do, you're sort of a target somehow because you're huge.
Yeah.
U2 is a grand example of that. Doesn't matter what they do, they're always going to be a target now. Did it feel like it was more for this record? Like there was more somehow louder opposing chatter?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, partly it's that we're bigger. Part of it is genuine response to the record, which is super fine. Part of it was the album launch, and then the people that were reviewing the album tend to be people who are more online and then were really exposed to the album launch in a way that I don't think the average listener was.
Right.
So they approached it with baggage that we created, so it's kind of our fault, but it was different. No, I mean, it's also fifth record. It's a long career. Bruce Springsteen actually told us once, just like, make sure that you can always play shows in Spain because there will come a time when people hate you for like a decade and you can just disappear and go play shows in Spain where people love you and you'll be in Spain and you can eat delicious food and then 10 years after people will realize that you're really great and then you go back to America.
Yeah. But you know, it's so great to have that kind of mentorship in a way, I guess, because...
No, it's wild that like Bruce Springsteen told us that. You're like,
that's
great.
Because we see... As we look back historically at musicians' arcs and everything, that you sort of, that everybody deals with that. If you've had it, if you have a long enough successful career, like there was even a time when people were mad at Neil Young more, you know, those 80s years, they weren't kind to him.
And David Bowie went through a very fallow period that people, that he has like talked about online and been like, that was a silly record. And then the end of his life, like put out the most bruising and brutal statement on his whole life. Yeah. It was stunning. And then he died, and it was, and it like, what a capstone. And while he was, and while he was making records that people didn't like, he was supporting bands like ours and supporting all sorts of bands and like playing amazing shows and like touring with great artists. So he was always doing varied levels of work.
I mean, to me, there was never a bigger mythical artist than David Bowie. The fact that you, you know, got that moment with him, those moments, you know, I remember watching the fashion show that you got. I remember seeing that a dozen times online and just watching that and just loving, you know, every bit of it, and how he ended up on the record. Yeah, I'm envy is not the right word because there's nothing for me to be envious about, but just like in awe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Of something like that. I mean, what an interesting life and career that you all get to have.
Yeah, seriously.
So the Everything Now tour, it eventually comes to a close, and you guys kind of go your separate ways for a little bit, and, I mean, and as you say, live your life.
Not like super separate. Like, I don't have a place in Montreal anymore. I'm in Brooklyn, but everyone else is tied to Montreal. Winter Regina are in New Orleans more, but that's my brother and sister-in-law, so I will be connected to them. Yeah, I bet we'll take a breather and then recharge and start on a record. Let's see.
Sir, keep doing it.
Yeah.
Well, I love it, man.
Thank you
for so much for this, for these town halls.
Oh.
Really, I think this is important work that you're doing. And somebody's got to do it. People got to do it. So, all right. Thank you, man.
Thank you.
And my thanks, Will Butler, again. The brand new solo record is called Generations. It's out now. Thanks to you as well for checking out this episode. Please, 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 before you get out, hit that subscribe button so you can keep up with all of the interviews that we do here. Again, 3 a week, one Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And you can subscribe anywhere you get your favorite podcast from. That does include iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or the video version of this at YouTube. And then after all of that, head over to WFPK.org. That's where I do a show Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern. That's an hour full of song premieres, music news, anniversary spins, and bonus interviews. Again, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern at WFPK.org. Consequence of Sound has your music and film news. You can also find me on the social media spots, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. All of them just at Kyle Meredith. And that does it for another edition. I'm Kyle Meredith, and I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.
It's easy to hear your favorite artist on WFPK from wherever you are. Listen on your smart speaker, live stream from our website at WFPK.org from Louisville Public Media.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com. Save big money.